Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. I have yet another deeply, deeply impressive guest with me today. I'm joined by an Olympian. Yes, you heard me right. I'm joined by an Olympian, Richard Cohen. However, he's not just an Olympian. He's also a prolific writer. He's produced books such as How to Write Like Tolstoy, Chasing the Sun, and A History of All Things Sword Fighting. His new book is absolutely fascinating, though. We don't like to use the word historiography on History Hack because everybody goes, it's a sort of fancy word and what does it even mean? But essentially, we're talking about, within the term historiography, the history of history. And Richard has written about the history of historians. So not perhaps quite what we think of when we think of historiography, but actually something perhaps a little bit more kind of key and fundamental in terms of our understanding. This is going to be a heck of a chat. Richard, great to talk to you. Welcome to History Hack. How are you doing?
Well, thank you for inviting me, and it's great to be on the show. And you're right. I tried not to mention the word historiography at all in the book. I think I failed a couple of times when I more or less had to put it in. But that was my strong prejudice.
Yeah, it is a taboo word for those who are trying to sort of help in terms of making history accessible. And I think there's just something about, perhaps it sounds a bit too much like geography. Perhaps it's a historian prejudice and we just don't like geography enough. And so you sound like you're fusing the two and we just run away screaming from that. Anyhow, let's start diving into this. This is a can of worms, I hope you don't mind me saying. It's a monumental task to try and unpick it all. What on earth made you want to do it?
Well, a can of worms is the best starting point if you want to catch some big fish. And I suppose the starting point came for me when I went to my main school when I was 13 and started studying medieval history, which is quite a stretch. And the scholarship paper was on the dissolution of the monasteries in 1536 and beyond. And my school was all boys school, set in the countryside outside Bath in Somerset. And it was run by Benedictine monks. And the main author of books on the dissolution of the monasteries then was a man called David Knowles. And his view on the monasteries were they had it coming to them. They were dissolute and didn't have much self-control and discipline and so on. But I learned that David Knowles was actually Dom David Knowles, as they call Benedictines, and he had been a monk at Downside, my school, and had been expelled for trying to foment a rebellion in the abbey, which is extraordinary. And I got hold of his unpublished autobiography. And what is clear is that he used his own beliefs and his feelings that the monks of his time were very ungodly and weren't following the proper rule, really to fuel the same prejudices which he took to his history books. Now, I hadn't read the autobiography when I was a teenager, obviously, but in my kind of dim teenage mind, I thought, this guy seems to have an agenda. And that kind of stuck with me. And I realized that the people who tell us about our past often have agendas and they vary widely. And I thought, you know, there's that famous saying by E.H. Carr, kind of 50s and 60s British historian, if you're interested in history, first ask about the historian. And that's what I wanted to do. And the book that I wanted to read didn't exist. So I thought, damn it, I'm going to have to write it.
Absolutely. I love that philosophy. Boy, we could go down so many rabbit holes with that straight away in terms of individual prejudices and can you divorce yourself from your own prejudices and so on. We might save that for a little bit later before we kind of go ultra philosophical on our listeners. But I'm going to start by putting you on the spot. Who is the father of history as a discipline?
Well, it's a great phrase, and everyone takes it to be, and I think properly takes it to be, Herodotus, who was born around 485, people say, died, that's BC, he died in 420 BC. So his coffee-drinking mates, as it were Plato, Sophocles, Aeschylus, that gang. But at the time that he was traveling for the book, which is probably his best known as The Histories, so it translates from the Greek as The Researches. History wasn't really a concept. People then didn't have, you know, a sense of a narrative. So his investigations marked a new consciousness, you know, abstract reasoning, connecting with the past in a new way. And I think that certain discoveries are necessary if a society is going to grow, and a sense of the past is one of them. But although Cicero called him father of history, that's how the tag began, and Plutarch, coming slightly later, said, yeah, but he makes up so many things, he's a father of lies as well. So he had these two epithets, father of history and father of lies, but he's a wonderful historian, and he does make a whole lot of things up, but whisper it, it's one of the things that makes him so readable.
This is a good point, but straight away you touched on something there, which is Plutarch turning around and making a critique of the notion of what it means to be a historian. It's not just a case of telling a story, it's a case of being able to determine viable truths within that story, which leads us straight on to the Romans and their version, because there's a certain irony here that a lot of Roman writers are kind of concerned about, you know, patronage, and there are their own agendas when it comes to their writing. And we quite often have, you know, ancient scholars on this show kind of talking about how, you know, person X says a certain thing, but we know that's a load of rubbish, because actually the person that is bankrolling them has an agenda against whoever this Roman writer is talking about. So when it comes to the ancient Romans, how useful, I guess, are their works, in the sense that, you know, if you take them at face value, then you have to accept that they can't be taken at face value. And if you're going to do that and take it as is written, you're going to be led up the garden path. How much of a problem is that? I mean, is it too much to say that they're useless?
It is too much to say. You know, some people say that all the Roman historians were doing was trying to make themselves look wonderful. But then that's what all historians are trying to do, prove that they know what their predecessors didn't. But the motives of the ancient Roman historians really varied a lot. Polybius, for instance, who was Greek, then wrote for the Romans, wanted to educate his fellow Greeks in the New World Order, to chart Rome's rise to power. But to that extent, he was a real educator. Sallust, who's called Ian Fleming, pretending he was Graham Greene, genuinely wanted to denounce corruption. Livy, who's more read than either of them, his agenda was to extol how great Rome was. And everything he wrote was focused on doing that. Tacitus too, the other great, great historian, was intent to provide moral lessons for his readers. Caesar, I think, was intent on just writing a better CV for himself for when he got even greater power. So that's quite a range of different motives. And, you know, if one understands where they were coming from, and they were all pretty privileged people who held kind of, as it were, ministerial positions, in Roman society at that time. So they were a privileged class, writing in leisure hours. One's got to sift what we read of their writings with what we know of their situation. And a lot of their writings give us wonderful pictures into the society of their time. So no, they're absolutely not useless. They're tremendous to read. And I had for the book to reread Caesar's accounts of his wars, which when a schoolboy I'd curse as I'd try to work out what on earth he was getting at. But in English translations, they still read wonderfully excitingly. They're full of battles and skirmishes and wrong decisions, acts of courage and cowardice. They're adventure stories. But for the most part, he writes about himself in the third person. They are wonderfully true accounts, ones which we now can say are accurate. Although, you know, when one tries to say, well, normally you try to put one account against another. Can we do that with the ancient Greeks or the ancient Romans? Somebody said a few years ago that what's left to us in terms of the books that survive from either societies is about the equivalent of a badly bombed out library. You know, we have so little that actually has come through to us. And very often, you know, I think it's Tullus, who we only know about his writings because they were found used as a cork in a bottle of wine. Tacitus's writings came down in one version, both the Annals and Agricola. So more by luck than judgment, we've got these wonderful writers, but useless they are not.
Absolutely, because you've tapped on a point that what within kind of historical circles is termed reading against the grain, which is this idea that you don't just take things at face value. And this is something, this might be a point at which to start sort of delving into the historian's craft, because it is important to make our listeners aware that just because a historian is a historian and they say something, doesn't necessarily actually mean that they know what they're talking about. And one area that is important here is specialism, with certain individuals, not just because you're a historian of a particular period, for example, in my case, Napoleonic Wars, doesn't mean I can sit here and wax lyrical about Roman history because I'm a dunce when it comes to Roman history. Is there any sense of at what point people start to make judgments on whether or not somebody is qualified to talk about what they're talking about? And I'm thinking particularly about what you were saying about Plutarch, describing Herodotus as father of lies. Do we have a kind of sense of a point at which people are sort of turning to historians and previous works and going, yeah, but that's not right, is it?
Well, you use the word historian lightly.
This is true.
As if we, you know, it's a currency which we can bite and say, no, that's the genuine thing. I mean, first of all, history means two things. It means the past, but it also means the accounts of the past, generally in writing, but, you know, you've got narrative paintings and all other forms that tell us about what the past was like. So it means that history in that sense is the past coming through a filter to us. And so one's got to be wary about which meaning of history is appropriate. And the same is true of historian. I mean, historians, so-called, didn't think of themselves as historians. The profession, in as much as it was ever a profession, really started in the last quarter, I'd say, of the 19th century, when you had this amazing German professor of history, as he became to be, Leopold von Ranke. And he had stumbled upon a whole lot of ambassadors' reports, reporting to the state of Venice, which, because of Venice's parlous plight at that time in the history of Italy, hadn't been used or known about. So he had this Aladdin's cave of amazing raw material and really made his reputation then using them for the books he was going to write. But that really made him think, well, science is in the ascendant in Germany, as indeed most universities throughout Europe and in the States. and scientists are getting good jobs in universities, and I want historians to be as esteemed and have a career structure and be decently paid and thought of. So he thought, well, first of all, we'll say that history is a science, not an art. Then we'll say it's a discipline, good word, discipline, good Germanic word too. And we'll say that it's crucial that you go to original sources, that you cite evidence. And he put forward a number of other things that he felt that if you were going to be writing history, you had to have these disciplines in mind. And it was very successful, one could argue to an extent, rightly so, because professorships in history spouted up everywhere. People got jobs as professional historians. And it changed the way history was taught. In fact, the whole way in which people studied for doctorates came from von Ranke. So he was really important, but I think he was also dangerously wrong in certain ways, in that although, if you like, his prejudice or his agenda was to establish history as a decent subject to spend one's life in, I wouldn't say founded, but certainly perpetuated the idea that it's the academy, it's professional historians who are the people who can talk about what the past was like. And one of the things that I try to do in my book is to say, well, at one level, we're all historians. If you say, you know, you'll never guess what happened to me yesterday. I was walking along in the street, and this beautiful woman came up to me and said, oh, I've heard your podcast. It's wonderful. I've fallen in love with you. And you'll be telling—
quite rightly so.
You'd be telling a narrative, and it'd be up to your listeners to decide whether this was real history or false facts. But I wanted to say that, you know, the writers of the Bible are an important source of our knowledge of the past. The dramatists, Shakespeare, for instance, I've got a chapter on Shakespeare because he's given us our ideas about Tudor monarchs and about leading ancient Roman figures, Antony, Cleopatra, and Julius Caesar. Which have really formed our idea of how, what those people were like. I mean, famously, Richard III. And I've got another chapter on historical novelists, because again, they have formed many people's ideas of whole ranges of what history has been. So I won't say, I mean, there's some wonderful historians, there's some wonderful living historians, but there are also historians who are marked by pedantry and bowing to their rivals and peers, saying, look how many footnotes I've put in, and look how many books I've read. And that can really kill off history. So I've tried to cast my net, I think fairly, but widely, to take in any kind of person, people who wouldn't necessarily ever have called themselves historians, who really have influenced our ideas of what the past has been.
So many things to follow up on there. Firstly, I couldn't help but chuckle at this idea that you could put historians on an equal footing to scientists. And I say this as somebody who has tried very hard to make it as a professional historian, but on no level would I put myself on a par with somebody who's solving climate change or curing cancer or any of these genuinely earth-changing and life-changing achievements. But is history a science? Oh, no, it's really not. History, I believe, had a muse, did it not? Right back in the Library of Alexandria, which in itself means that it has to be an art.
Well, you know, one puts labels on things. Science itself was a word that only came in the 19th century to be used over that whole range of inquiries, which we now put under the heading science. The word historian didn't make it into English dictionaries until that century. So, you know, these are pretty relatively recent labels anyway. And the people who wrote about the past didn't say, oh, I am a historian. You know, so one's got to be careful. There are what we might call scientific elements to writing history, and there are artistic elements. We don't have to say whether it's a science or an art, unless you have got a particular failure for loving for pigeonholing things.
This is very true. And just to really mess with people's heads, there are some historians like myself who try and fuse the two So we take a data analytical approach, a sciencey approach to studying the past through, I mean, it's known as fusing the qualitative and the quantitative methods of history. Fancy terminology for basically using any information you can get your hands on, including a shed load of data, and seeing what it tells you. So I like these points that you're making. You gave us some lovely little teasers that I want to start to dig into, though. One of which was
the teaser.
One of which
you've got a pedant on your program. I'm sorry, listeners.
I'm not sure I've ever been heckled by a guest before. This is a new experience. Quick, let's move it on before the anarchy reigns. Otherwise, I'll get fired by my boss. One of the chapters that you look at is talking about the creation of the Bible. Where do you even start with analyzing that? Because this is probably going to make me unpopular with some of a Christian disposition, but the Bible is in itself a translation, and it's a selection of previous materials. It was never just kind of flatly presented at one moment in time as here is the definitive article. So, and there's this whole thing about, you know, the redacted text, the gospels that never made it into the current version. So where do you start with unpicking all of that, especially when you think about a lot of what I've said is specifically New Testament, never mind the Old Testament?
Well, you start with a stiff drink. Then you have a second.
Sounds like you'd fit in down the pub on History Hack.
What I started with was going to people who really knew the subject. I said I was brought up by Benedictine monks. Catholics get teased for knowing the New Testament and being really pig ignorant about the Old Testament. I went to, among others, John Barton, who's Emeritus Professor of Theology at Oxford University. He kind of marked my card. And then in terms of unraveling just who wrote the main historical sections in the Old Testament, there's a wonderful man, he's still alive, he's 76 now, called Richard Friedman, who wrote a book called Who Wrote the Bible, which was published in 1987. And then there's a recent revising of it, published in 1997. So, well, that's over 20 years ago. So maybe he'll revise it again. But it's like a mystery or detective story over who the writers of the Old Testament were and how they interacted and who put it all together and so on. And I was convinced, not only by Friedman's accounts and people who've commented on his writings, but then going on to the New Testament and so on, that the Bible, both old and new, is a work of propaganda. And it's not history per se, and it includes wonderful, important aspects about the past. And as a cultural artifact, it's obviously the most influential book that's ever been published. Although you might say that the Quran and the Talmud come in along with it. But all three are works of propaganda. That, depending on your point of view, you may say they're propagating important truths, but they're not history in the way that we should understand that word to be. As I say, I very much rested on guidance of some wonderful academic historians.
Let's keep kind of going through some of these teasers that you gave us then. I'm going to be honest, I'm certainly guilty of this next one, the sort of Western-centric perspective, that habit, and it goes even down to a national level, doesn't it? Sort of the Anglo-centric perspective. We have this habit of viewing things through lenses that we are most familiar with, whether that be culturally, nationally, whatever it might be. But you have looked at the other side, haven't you, in terms of things like the Islamic view of history. Give us a little bit of a flavour of that, the importance of that difference of perspective and where it leads you.
Well, what I wanted to do was write about accounts of the past, which have influenced our understanding of the past. The one kind of touchstone criterion was people who really influenced us. And the truth is, whether we like it or not, that the people who have are mainly from Western Europe and North America. But you know, if I looked at writings about Africa, if they weren't written by Western Europeans, there's African historiography didn't really become organized at the academic level until halfway through the last century. Books on South America by people who were actually from South America, nothing before 1993, real influence. China, well, people say, the father of Chinese history is Sima Quan, who was born in 145 BC. And I'm sure he has influenced Chinese historians, though more recent Chinese historians have said 2,000 years of Chinese history was totally made up. So I found that it wasn't just my personal prejudices or limitations that made me limit what I covered to mainly Western Europe and North America. Although I felt that I could get into Islamic history quite a bit. And there's a chapter on Islamic history and Muhammad and the importance of the Quran to our understanding of the past. But I take al-Tabiri, who was born in 838 AD, an even greater historian called Ibn Khaldun, who was a 14th century historian. And I go into them in detail because we know quite a lot about their lives and what they were like. And it may not be strictly relevant to your listeners that Tabari didn't have a gray hair on into his 80s and kept all his hair and his beard until then. But it gives you this a visual sense of this extraordinary person who, with people at his feet, he would talk at such a speed that his pupils couldn't write down quickly enough what he was saying. But what I learned was that Islamic history began as an oral tradition, and people who wrote things down were really thought of as weaklings. And weren't respected. At one time, historians were thought to be beneath prostitutes in the layer of who won respect or failed to get any. And then when people did write things down, it was having respect for your ancestors. And then along came Muhammad, after him came the Quran, and believers in Islam said, well, that's the only thing you need. All you need to read is the Quran and learned commentary on the Quran. And if you're a historian, it's quite clear what your job is. You've got to refer to the learned scholar before him, and then the learned scholar before him, and then the learned scholar before him, with the result that most Islamic history is very, very repetitive. And we know from the most radical wing of Islam that you go against that way of doing things at your peril. And so although over the centuries, there have been some wonderfully lively Islamic writers, now particularly history is being closed down in those countries. And what you get is everybody towing the party religious line. And I was sad to write about Islamic history for that reason, but it seemed a terrible example of what in many ways is true of countries that were heavily Christian. You had to toe the line in terms of what the church, whether it was the Vatican or other denominations, said was what you must do. You had to write about history with a God in his heaven. So I'm not simply criticizing the limitations of Islamic history. But it was an example of what really narrowed thinking can lead to.
I'm still reeling ever so slightly from the revelation about that guy who didn't lose any hair and didn't turn grey even into his 80s, which I'd love to know his secret is all I'll say. But I'm going to stay with what you were sort of starting to talk about there, which is sort of the medieval period and the influence, particularly of religion, on that kind of perception that we have of sort of monks scrolling away in chronicles and so on. Because as you say, there is that religious agenda, and sort of if somebody isn't of your particular branch of Christianity, then they're sort of barbaric, and a whole host of other insults can sort of ensue. So how much does that prejudice kind of influence the way in which we look at the histories that are written during that period?
Well, very much so. I mean, the writing of history, particularly by religious orders, is the only history, the some secular historians of note, from the 4th century through to the end of the Middle Ages, wherever you put that to be, but certainly, you know, running into the Renaissance. You've got some wonderful historians during that time, but they were generally religious professionals. In France, you had Gregory of Tours, who was a bishop, and he was a 6th century figure, died in 594. He used to be described by John Bowers, a wonderful now dead historian, as Trollope with bloodshed. And there was this bishop writing about fornicators, treacherous, murderers, really the kind of super gossip of his time. But he had a regard for sources, but by and large, he was a bishop. And he wrote all kinds of religious treatises as well. And so it was the telling of the past constricted by what he had to have as his religious shell, as it were. And you go on through to take a hugely influential English historian, the Venerable Bede, who wrote a history of the history of the English speaking people. And he died in 735. Well, read his accounts, and they're very lively, but it's miracles, miracles all the way. And you think, well, here's this person who really seems to sift his sources and pay regard to what the evidence he can glean. But in the end, everything is subject to the limited Christian beliefs of his time. And you can go on through the years, and until you reach really Voltaire in France and Edward Gibbon with his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, maybe the most famous work of history one can think of outside the Bible, where they went out of their way to say, well, actually, folks, I want to use my individual judgment, and I'm not going to take the church as being the ruling arbiter of what has happened. And in fact, chapters 15 and 16, I think it is, in Gibbon's multi-volume book, are precisely about how the Christian church brought down the Roman Empire by introducing certain Christian beliefs. But both those men, Voltaire and Gibbon, were determined that if you're going to write about history, you could write what you liked, and you didn't have some priestly censor telling you what was right and wrong or admissible and not. Now, in reply, church historians massed their armies, and by the 19th century, you've got a military force of Christian apologists shaping the history they felt people should believe in. So it's been a great battle, and you could argue that it's not until the 20th century that certainly Western European historians felt that they were free not to have to write according to a particular ology, communism or Christianity or whatever. But it's a fierce fight, and was for several centuries.
Wow. I want to talk Shakespeare as well, just to really kind of keep the heavy punches going on this. There's a divide amongst the people who run History Hack between the sort of villain of epic proportions when it comes to history versus, well, it's okay because his writings when it comes to plays and so on are brilliant. Is he a villain of epic proportions? I guess Richard III would have kind of thought so if he was able to comment from beyond the grave.
I think it's a nice idea that you can describe Shakespeare relevantly or truthfully as a villain rather than a wonderful creator of fantastic villains. One thing I think I would say is, you know, you say, people, or I say, people have got an agenda, people are prejudiced. Well, there's some wonderful works of history, maybe most works of history, are prejudiced accounts. I remember interviewing the now dead, wonderful historian, Eric Hobsbawm. And I said, can you ever be an objective historian? And he just sat back in his chair in his 90s and laughed and said, no, of course not. But I try to obey the rules. Now, you can talk about what the rules might be, and you can talk about whether Shakespeare obeyed rules. And one knows that, you know, Shakespeare made a lot of things up because he was writing propaganda, you know. Now, whether you say he wrote 37, 38, 39 plays, more than half of them are rooted in history. Not necessarily called histories, but that's what they are. But, you know, Wars of the Roses, 1399, 1487, long period. But, well, they weren't an unceasing period of bloody confrontation, which is what Shakespeare makes them. You know, I think in all the history plays, the only one shown to be an admirable ruler, ironically, is Henry VIII. Henry VI is a trilogy about patriotic feeling or attempting to stir that up. He had absolute agendas, which is one of the reasons why his portrait of Richard III, being an awful child killer and all the rest, was the most popular play in his time, outselling all the others, and is still one of his most popular plays. But you both get a lot of valid history, or history that we know Shakespeare got right, and in blatant rewritings of history, you know, people who were children at the time of his writing, and in fact, he presents as grown-ups, or all kinds of things which aren't true, they've still formed our sense. I mean, Richard III Shakespeare's Richard III is our Richard III. Shakespeare's Cleopatra is as we see her. And maybe that shouldn't be the case, but there are enough people who try to correct that Richard III and say, this kind person who you'd have as a babysitter any day of the week. So you've got to be careful when reading Shakespeare's work as to what you say it might be true and might not be. And what you can't question is the fact that he's really influenced our understanding of key periods.
Absolutely, which kind of taps into another thing that keeps kind of cropping up in this episode, which is sort of history's propaganda. Who would you say are the major culprits? Or to some extent, are we all culprits when it comes to this?
I think that there may be historians who you would say weren't propagandizing their views. But you know, most countries have supplied bits of history to order. The most famous history of Japan, which is an 8th century chronicles, has so many fabrications, it's been described as one of the greatest historical frauds ever perpetrated. I've talked about China and Chinese historians just making up what they thought their country's past should be. But I suppose that although, you know, you say, well, are British historians free from being propagandists? You take, you know, going back to the Middle Ages, people like Geoffrey of Monmouth, who took the Merlin and Arthur myths, stirred in total fabrications. Guinevere, Gawain, Lancelot, they were making myths so that Britain had an early history full of heroes and villains and magicians and whatever, which enriched our understanding of the past, but it was a past which never existed. But when you say kind of major culprits, Japan and China, yes, but I think my villain of the day would be Putin. And it's not just that Vladimir Putin, over everything that's happening in Ukraine and in the lead up to the war in Ukraine, has been falsified by Putin and his government. It's that that is only a continuation of what Putin was doing over the whole of Russian and Soviet history, as soon as Putin came to power, that he ordered certain textbooks to be shut down, made a government textbook publisher, the publishers of the texts, which he said were the only ones were to be used in Russian schools and colleges, apart from anything else, a very lucrative thing, as you know, print runs in Russia can run to a million copies a time. But he has gone on the attack to say that Russian historians should preach and write the patriotic version of what Russian history has been. He's closed down organizations like Memorial, which was telling the truth about the gulags under Stalin and the prison camps, because that's, not very good, in his view, to the image of Russia, rather than realizing that being accurate about even the bad parts or bad aspects of one's country's history lead to a greater understanding of, you know, what history is and what your country's place in the world is. And in the end, you get found out. It may take a very long time for the truth to be revealed. But, you know, the fact that we have such an understanding of the gulag camps comes from Solzhenitsyn, a novelist, not a historian. And his trilogy on the gulag camps has probably been the most influential work by a novelist on our understanding of history of any novel or work of fiction ever published. Anyway, wow. That's going on to novelists, but Putin is my villain number one.
Well, let's stay with novelists. I must admit, I've never sort of sat down and considered who might have the biggest impact. Certainly, I find myself sort of banging a head against a brick wall that consists of the work of Victor Hugo and Les Miserables when it comes to people's understanding of Waterloo. Love Les Mis, though I do. The account we get from that book about the battle is one of my big bugbears when it comes to this period. But who would you say are the big voices in terms of influencing our thoughts on the past beyond Shakespeare that we've talked about already?
Well, Waterloo, you can take Stendhal, and you can take War and Peace. Tolstoy refused to have War and Peace called a novel, and he didn't want it called a work of history either. He generally was an absolute nuisance to his publishers and to the press, because he said he's writing a new kind of book. But he studied the source material fantastically. I mean, he'd been Cossack and covering earlier wars than the Napoleonic Wars. And so he was a fantastic amateur historian. And what you get through a whole range of novelists is Tolstoy, in his crazy way, marvelous way, and Solzhenitsyn were trying to tell the truth as they saw it, which had been hidden in official accounts. Novelists more generally are trying to tell truths which the professional historian either can't know or to an extent isn't interested in. And, you know, I say up to the present day, we've got the instance of Hilary Mantel, who I think was fed up with the view of Cromwell we get from Robert Bolt's famous play, A Man for All Seasons, and Thomas More was, you know, the saintly Thomas More. So she wrote her account. I interviewed her once and said, yeah, I acted in that play. Who do you think I played? And she said, without having had any clue beforehand, Cromwell. And of course, she was right. But she said, you know, Cromwell is a far more interesting figure and a more sympathetic figure. But she says, you know, what we've got is just, we're sieving through the details we've got about the past. And the novelist can, by imaginative recreation, give you a sense of what the archives don't tell us. The emotions of the people we may get from letters, diaries, all kinds of other things, but it's the imaginative gift of the novelist that supplies what a lot of official histories can't give us.
There's certainly some significant truth in that. I mean, in a lot of respects, historians are encouraged to divorce the emotion from their work, certainly today. That is, you know, what you're encouraged to do as part of, I mean, it goes back to that conversation that you were having with Eric Hobsbawm. One of the ways that you can try and get closer to not being influenced by your own experiences, but nonetheless you will be, is to try and remove the emotion from your subject of study. But nonetheless, your perspectives and what interests you are likely going to be influenced by your personality and your lived experience. Can I ask about women? What role do women play in your book and in within this story?
I'm going to go back to the last issue just on one point, and that there's a wonderful moment in one of Tom Stoppard's plays on the life of journalists. And say two journalists are covering a war in distant parts. And one of the journalists says, yeah, but you know, I'm really trying to be objective. I think I can be objective in my coverage. And his co-journalist said, yeah. Well, you may be, but are you being objective for or objective against? Even when you think you're being objective, things get in the way. Now, when it comes to women, you know, there were no female voices from the ancient world. You think of the Odyssey and Telemachus telling his mother, speech will be the business of men. And that's gone on through the ages. Aristotle saw women as defective men. Clever women were a threat to men. A late 15th century work commissioned by the papacy said, woman is an imperfect animal. She always deceives. She is an inescapable punishment, a necessary evil, a desirable calamity, a delectable detriment, an evil of nature. Well, I'm sure you don't agree with that. We don't now. But in terms of women getting to write, although I do quote women historians throughout the book, I've devoted one chapter just to them, because I wanted to underline that although there are one or two exceptions, you've got a second century AD Chinese woman historian who took on the writing of history from her father and brother and became a very fine historian in her own right. But they're the exceptions that prove the rule. And it's only when you get into the 19th century and early 20th century, particularly when you get normally women from privileged background who'd been given a good education, allowed that, do you at last get women in any numbers writing important works of history. And it's not only that they weren't allowed to, it's very difficult to write the history of women because their accounts weren't kept, that their diaries, their letters, or that kind of original material about them wasn't thought to be important. So then if you were wanting to write about a woman in the American Civil War, you'd have to look it up in archives about their husband or their lovers or whatever to find anything about them. So women have been twice dispossessed, not regarded as people who were capable or should be writing about the past, but their place in the past was diminished and scorned. So that's all part of the story of individual people and how they had to fight to be recognized.
It absolutely is. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but there are a couple of things I just want to touch on before we go, because this book brings us right up to the modern day. And there are a couple of themes that are quite relevant to your book. And the first is the era of fake news. How and to what extent does that threaten history? Or do you think that this is a bump that can be ridden out with the passage of time? Or is it just part and parcel of what actually has happened for the previous two millennia?
Well, you say that in those innocent, you know, pure tones, but there at the beginning of all your installments, either you or one of your colleagues says, tell everyone we're incredible. I want to tell everyone that you're credible, that you're putting across true history. One of the problems is that fake news is very difficult to counter. And it's only by coming together to fight against fakery that we've got a chance of limiting, you know, in the days of the internet and the power of all the various ways in which the internet can get false stories across, that we've got a chance. And the power of the internet and fake news joins with the fact that, as if I'm jumping on a soapbox here and preaching, but I want to, that history is under attack. Good accounts of the past are under attack. And they're under attack also from dictators, so that power brokers are the enemies of good history. And you've got not just Putin, but last November in America, it was front page news that President Xi of China had said he wants to rewrite the history of China to make it more glorious and to whitewash moments or periods in Chinese history which weren't to his liking. You've got Trump doing the same thing. And to my mind, the whole way in which history should be taught in American schools, you've got a division right down the center of America over what is the right way, what kind of things should be taught and which shouldn't. And so there's a real fight against dictators world over. I just named, I'm not sure you call Trump a dictator, but I would. Trump, Xi, Putin, and others determined that the way children and the population in general should be led into an understanding of the past is the government version. So it's fake news, obviously overlapping with government propagandist news, which are the enemies of people who are really interested to get the past right, as far as one ever can.
Yeah, the idea of governments deciding what does and doesn't matter in a nation's historical narrative is always going to be deeply, deeply problematic. I want to stay with controversial modern figures if we can, just to finish off. And I'm thinking particularly here of David Starkey, who caused a huge amount of controversy for reasons that listeners will be familiar with. We took it from your book that you kind of think that this is unfinished history as far as particularly Starkey's concerned at this point. Is that fair?
If you mean that Starkey might rehabilitate himself, I think that the damage over one particular sentence, really, that he wrote will never be completely done away with. But he always loved to be unpopular. The most unpopular man in Britain at one point was a sobriquet of his, and he relished it. But you know, he's lost nearly all, if not all, his professional positions, a whole lot of other positions which he relished. So it's been an awful downfall, which you could argue, I wouldn't say that he didn't deserve to be heavily admonished, but it's a terrible story. But it's not unique. I mean, in the 50s and 60s, the leading British historians were, take three of them. You've got A.J.P. Taylor, who wrote The Origins of the Second World War in 1961. And just to be the rogue historian, to stir things up, He said, well, what if Hitler had never intended to go to war? What if Britain's appeasers had really played a rather good hand when they went to Munich and so on? Anyway, a whole range of things which really got the historical establishment coming down on him like a ton of bricks and ruined his chances of further advancement in the academic world of history. And one of his greatest critics was Hugh Trevor Roper, his great rival, who had enjoyed a star reputation, you know, ever since his first book on Archbishop Laud. And he said, it's not surprising that historians of Laud so far have not written about Laud being able to see very far as they approach their subject down on their knees. But his reputation never recovered from when he was asked in 1983, paid I think £10,000, which was even more in 1983 than it sounds, by Rupert Murdoch to authenticate the so-called Hitler diaries, which had been unearthed, so people were told, in a hayloft in Germany. And for reasons best known to himself said they were genuine. And then he changed his mind at the last moment. And Murdoch told that he didn't authenticate them any longer, said, publish them with an epithet I wouldn't use on your program. Well, that ruined Trevor Roper's reputation. All the good work, the good history, everything he'd ever done went for naught. And he was actually a director of Times newspapers. And you thought when he died, he might have got a sympathetic obituary. The obituary heading led authenticator of Hitler diaries hoax dies. So you can go on to, I said, I'd name three. Another one was Eric Hobsbawm, who wrote, you know, wonderful histories, The Age of Extremes, The Age of Capital, The Age of Empire, but he never gave up being a member of the Communist Party. And even after the invasion of Hungary in 56, what happened in Czechoslovakia again, invading in 1968, when so many communists throughout the world said this is appalling, and either gave up their belief in communism or felt that they would very intensely criticize what the Soviet Union was doing. Hobsbawm was very muted in his criticism and wouldn't give up party affiliation. And that again ruined his reputation. So one of the stories, I suppose, a thread running through the whole of my book, is how people who wrote marvelous history allowed, well, I think in the case of Starkey and A.G.P. Taylor and Trevor Roper, they fell in love with their own publicity or their love of publicity. With Hobsbawm, it was more complicated in that he'd grown up in Germany and saw his country falling apart. And he saw the communists and the fascists trying to come up with an ism, a belief structure that would give people hope. And as a teenager, he fell in with the communists, delivered leaflets for them, hid printing stuff underneath his bed, for which he might have been put to death by marauding brown shirts. Communism gave him a home. It was his rosebud, thinking back to the Citizen Kane film. He was emotionally so connected to what solace he'd got as a teenage boy that he was never going to be that disloyal, even though it cost him at least one part of his reputation. So to that extent, Starkey is a member of a particular small but sad tribe, people who lost, what is it in Shakespeare, Iago, reputation, my reputation, just by one particular act or belief.
I'm glad you talked us through the Hobsbawm thing. So we're going to ask whether or not he kind of ever regretted that in later life with you having interviewed him. But I gather not, because for him, you know, he did it for the right kinds of reasons. Richard, this has been so interesting. Thank you so much for giving up your time.
Oh, thank you.
So remind people, the book, where can they get it? What's it called? all of the usual things. And also, where can people find out about your work?
Well, if they ring, if they get onto my page on the internet, Richard Cohen Author, they'll find out about my writings, and also there's a whole series of me and my anecdotish stories about historians, how Salman Rushdie once dated the winner of Miss Universe, all kinds of things which they may find enjoyable. My book, Making History, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, or if you're listening in the States, same version, same book, but with a different cover, by Simon and Schuster, available in all good bookshops, not just Amazon. And you can also find on Amazon, if you want to read the reviews it's had, which so far, fingers crossed, have been very nice, which didn't cost me too much in paying off people. And so apart from the woman, the gorgeously beautiful woman, if one's allowed to say such a thing, who's waiting for you downstairs, everybody else should, I hope, rush out and read them, because my daughter, who lives in Manchester, where she's a doctor, came over to where I live in New York in January and picked up a page proof of Making History. And she said, I found her reading it at breakfast. And she said, I don't normally like reading books like this, but I'm really enjoying this. And to get one of your children saying something like that was, it justified all the 10 years I spent in putting this book together.
I mean, there's an accolade and a review if ever people needed one. But frankly, having listened to you for the last hour, I don't think they will have needed that commendation, because your passion and your knowledge speak for themselves. Richard, thank you so much for your time. It's been a joy.
Thank you.